Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Episode 10 of Space Prison by Tom Godwin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Space Prison, Episode 10. Schroeder was returning from a trip he had taken alone to the east, coming down the long canyon that led from the high face of the plateau to the country near the caves. He hurried, glancing back at the black clouds that had gathered so quickly on the mountain behind him. Thunder rumbled from within them, an almost continuous roll of it as the clouds poured down their deluge of water. A cloudburst was coming, and the sheer-walled canyon down which he hurried had suddenly become a death-trap, its sunlit quiet soon to be transformed into roaring destruction. There was only one place along its 9-mile length where he might climb out, and the time was already short in which to reach it. He had increased his pace to a trot when he came to it, a talus of broken rock that sloped up steeply for 30 feet to a shelf. A ledge 11 feet high stood over the shelf, and other lower ledges set back from it, like climbing steps. At the foot of the talus he stopped to listen, wondering how close behind him the water might be. He heard it coming, a sound like the roaring of a high wind up the canyon, and he scrambled up the talus of loose rock to the shelf at its top. The shelf was not high enough above the canyon's floor. He would be killed there. And he followed it 50 feet around a sharp bend. There it narrowed abruptly to merge into the sheer wall of the canyon. Blind alley. He ran back to the top of the talus where the edge of the ledge, ragged with projections of rock, was unreachably far above him. As he did so, the roaring was suddenly a crashing, booming thunder, and he saw the water coming. It swept around the bend at perhaps 100 miles an hour. Stretching from wall to wall of the canyon, the crest of it seething and slashing and towering 40 sheer feet above the canyon's floor. A prowler was running in front of it, running for its life and losing. There was no time to watch. He leaped upward, as high as possible, his crossbow in his hand. He caught the edge of the bow over one of the sharp projections of rock on the ledge's rim, and began to pull himself up, afraid to hurry lest the rock cut the bowstring in two and drop him back. It held, and he stood on the ledge, safe, as the prowler flashed up the talus below. It darted around the blind alley shelf and was back a moment later. It saw that its only chance would be to leap up on the ledge where he stood, and it tried, handicapped by the steep, loose sleep it had to jump from. It failed and fell back. It tried again, hurling itself upward with all its strength, and its claws caught fleetingly on the rough rock a foot below the rim. It began to slide back, with no time left it for a third try. It looked up at the rim of safety that it had not quite reached, and then on up at him, its eyes bright and cold with the knowledge that it was going to die and its enemy would watch it. Schroeder dropped flat on his stomach and reached down, past the massive black head, to seize the prowler by the back of the neck. He pulled up with all his strength, and the claws of the prowler tore at the rocks as it climbed. When it was coming over the ledge safe, he rolled back from it and came to his feet in one swift, wary motion, his eyes on it and his knife already in his hand. As he did so, the water went past below them with a thunder that deafened. Logs and trees shot past, boulders crashed together, and things could be seen surging in the brown depths, shapeless things that had once been woods goats and the battered gray bulk of a unicorn. He saw it all with a sideward glance, his attention on the prowler. It stepped back from the rim of the ledge and looked at him, warily, as he looked at it. With the wariness was something like question and almost disbelief. The ledge they stood on was narrow, but it led out of the canyon and to the open land beyond. He motioned to the prowler to precede him, and, hesitating a moment, it did so. They climbed out of the canyon and out onto the grassy slope of the mountainside. The roar of the water was a distant rumble there, and he stopped. The prowler did the same, and they watched each other again, each of them trying to understand what the thoughts of the other might be. It was something they could not know. They were too alien to each other and had been enemies too long. Then a gust of wind swept across them, bending and rippling the tall grass, and the prowler swung away to go with it and leave him standing alone. His route was such that it diverged gradually from that taken by the prowler. He went through a grove of trees and emerged into an open glade on the other side. Up on the ridge to his right, he saw something black for a moment, already far away. He was 30 feet from the next grove of trees when he saw the gray shadow waiting silently for his coming within them. Unicorn. His crossbow rattled as he jerked back the pistol grip. The unicorn charged, the underbrush crackling as it tore through it and a vine whipping like a rope from its lowered horn. His first arrow went into its chest. It lurched, fatally wounded but still coming, and he jerked back on the pistol grip for the quick shot that would stop it. The rock-frayed bowstring broke with a singing sound, and the bow end snapped harmlessly forward. He had counted on the bow, and its failure came a fraction of a second too late for him to dodge far enough. His sideward leap was short, and the horn caught him in mid-air, ripping across his ribs and breaking them, shattering the bone of his left arm and tearing the flesh. He was hurled 15 feet, and he struck the ground with a stunning impact, pain washing over him in a blinding wave. Through it, dimly, he saw the unicorn fall, and heard its dying trumpet blast as it called to another. He heard an answering call somewhere in the distance, and then the faraway drumming of hooves. He fought back the blindness and used his good arm to lift himself up. His bow was useless, his spear lay broken under the unicorn, and his knife was gone. His left arm swung helplessly, and he could not climb the limbless lower trunk of a lance tree with only one arm. He went forward limping, trying to hurry to find his knife while the drumming of the hooves raced toward him. It would be a battle already lost that he would make with the short knife, but he would have blood for his going. The grass grew tall and thick, hiding the knife until he could hear the unicorn crashing through the trees. He saw it 10 feet ahead of him as the unicorn tore out of the edge of the woods 30 feet away. It squealed, shrill with triumph, and the horn swept up to impale him. There was no time left to reach the knife, no time left for anything but the last fleeting sight of sunshine and glade and arching blue sky. Something from behind him shot past and up at the unicorn's throat, a thing that was snarling with black savagery, with yellow eyes blazing and white fangs slashing, the prowler. It ripped at the unicorn's throat, swerving its charge, and the unicorn plunged past him. The unicorn swung back, all the triumph gone from its squeal, and the prowler struck again. They became a swirling blur, the horn of the unicorn swinging and stabbing and the attacks of the prowler like the swift, relentless thrust of a rapier. He went to his knife, and when he turned back with it in his hand, the battle was already over. The unicorn fell, and the prowler turned away from it. One foreleg was bathed in blood, and its chest was heaving with a panting so fast that it could not have been caused by the fight with the unicorn. "It must have been watching me," he thought, with a strange feeling of wonder. It was watching from the ridge, and it ran all the way. Its yellow eyes flickered to the knife in his hand. He dropped the knife in the grass and walked forward, unarmed, wanting the prowler to know that he understood, that for them in that moment the gulf of 250 light-years did not exist. He stopped near it and squatted in the grass to begin binding up his broken arm, so the bones would not grate together. It watched him. Then it began to lick at its bloody shoulder, standing so close to him that he could have reached out and touched it. Again he felt the sense of wonder. They were alone together in the glade, he and a prowler, each caring for his hurts. There was a bond between them that for a little while made them like brothers. There was a bridge for a little while across the gulf that had never been bridged before. When he had finished with his arm and the prowler had lessened the bleeding of its shoulder, it took a step back toward the ridge. He stood up, knowing it was going to leave. "I suppose the score is even now," he said to it, "and we'll never see each other again. So, good hunting, and thanks." It made a sound in its throat, a queer sound that was neither bark nor growl, and he had the feeling it was trying to tell him something. Then it turned and it was gone, like a black shadow across the grass, and he was alone again. He picked up his knife and bow and began the long, painful journey back to the caves, looking again and again at the ridge behind him and thinking, "They have a code of ethics. They fight for their survival, but they pay their debts." Ragnarok was big enough for both men and prowlers. They could live together in friendship as men and dogs of Earth lived together. It might take a long time to win the trust of the prowlers, but surely it could be done. He came to the rocky trail that led to the caves, and there he took a last look at the ridge behind him, feeling a poignant sense of loss and wondering if he would ever see the prowler again, or ever again know the strange, wild companionship he had known that day. Perhaps he never would, but the time would come on Ragnarok when children would play in the grass with prowler pups, and the time would come when men and prowlers, side by side, would face the Gurns. In the year that followed, there were two incidents when a prowler had the opportunity to kill a hunter on prowler territory and did not do so. There was no way of knowing if the prowler in each case had been the one he had saved from the cloudburst, or if the prowlers, as a whole, were respecting what a human had done for one of them. Schroeder thought of again trying to capture prowler pups, very young ones, and decided it would be a stupid plan. Such an act would destroy all that had been done toward winning the trust of the prowlers. It would be better to wait, even though time was growing short, and find some other way. The fall of 163 came, and the suns were noticeably moving south. That was the fall that his third child, a girl, was born. She was named Julia, after the Julia of long ago, and she was of the last generation that would be born in the caves. Plans were already underway to build a town in the valley, a mile from the caves. The unicorn-proof stockade wall that would enclose it was already under construction, being made of stone blocks. The houses would be of diamond-sawed stone, thick-walled, with dead air spaces between the double walls to insulate against heat and cold. Tall, wide canopies of lance-tree poles and the palm-like Medusa bush leaves would be built over all the houses to supply additional shade. The woods goats were fully adapted that year and domesticated to such an extent that they had no desire to migrate with the wild goats. There was a small herd of them then, enough to supply a limited amount of milk, cheese, and wool. The adaptation of the unicorns proceeded in the following years, but not their domestication. It was their nature to be ill-tempered and treacherous, and only the threat of the spears in the hands of their drivers forced them to work. Work that they could have done easily had they not diverted so much effort each day to trying to turn on their masters and kill them. Each night they were put in a massive walled corral, for they were almost as dangerous as wild unicorns. The slow, painstaking work on the transmitter continued while the suns moved farther south each year. The move from the caves to the new town was made in 179, the year that Schroeder's wife died. His two sons were grown and married, and Julia, at 16, was a woman by Ragnarok standards. Blue-eyed and black-haired as her mother, a Craig, had been, and strikingly pretty in a wild, reckless way. She married Will Humboldt that spring, leaving her father alone in the new house in the new town. 4 months later, she came to him to announce with pride and excitement, "I'm going to have a baby in only 6 months. If it's a boy, he'll be the right age to be leader when the Gurns come, and we're going to name him John, after the John who was the first leader we ever had on Ragnarok." Her words brought to his mind a question, and he thought of what old Dale Craig, the leader who had preceded Lake, had written. "We have survived the generations that the Gurns thought would never be born. But we must never forget the characteristics that ensured that survival, an unswerving loyalty of every individual to all the others, and the courage to fight and die if necessary. In any year now, the Gurns will come. There will be no one to help us. Those on Athena are slaves, and it is probable that Earth has been enslaved by now. We will stand or fall alone. But if we of today could know that the ones who meet the Gurns will still have the courage and loyalty that made our survival possible, then we would know that the Gurns are already defeated." The era of danger and violence was over for a little while. The younger generation had grown up during a time of peaceful development of their environment. It was a peace that the coming of the Gurns would shatter. But had it softened the courage and loyalty of the younger generation? A week later, he was given his answer. He was climbing up the hill that morning, high above the town below, when he saw the blue of Julia's wool blouse in the distance. She was sitting up on a hillside, an open book in her lap, and her short spear lying beside her. He frowned at the sight. The main southward migration of unicorns was over, but there were often lone stragglers who might appear at any time. He had warned her that some day a unicorn would kill her, but she was reckless by nature and given to restless moods in which she could not stand the confinement of the town. She jerked up her head as he watched, as though at a faint sound, and he saw the first movement within the trees behind her, a unicorn. It lunged forward, its stealth abandoned as she heard it, and she came to her feet in a swift, smooth movement, the spear in her hand and the book spilling to the ground. The unicorn's squeal rang out, and she whirled to face it, with 2 seconds to live. He reached for his bow, knowing his help would come too late. She did the only thing possible that might enable her to survive. She shifted her balance to take advantage of the fact that a human could jump to one side a little more quickly than a 4-footed beast in headlong charge. As she did so, she brought up the spear for the thrust into the vulnerable area just behind the jawbone. It seemed the needle point of the black horn was no more than an arm's length from her stomach when she jumped aside with the lithe quickness of a prowler, swinging as she jumped and thrusting the spear with all her strength into the unicorn's neck. The thrust was true, and the spear went deep. She released it and flung herself backward to dodge the flying hooves. The force of the unicorn's charge took it past her, but its legs collapsed under it and it crashed to the ground, sliding a little way before it stopped. It kicked once and lay still. She went to it to retrieve her spear, and even from the distance there was an air of pride about her as she walked past her bulky victim. Then she saw the book knocked to one side by the unicorn's hooves. Tatters of its pages were blowing in the wind, and she stiffened, her face growing pale. She ran to try to pick it up, the unicorn forgotten. She was trying to smooth the torn leaves when he reached her. It had been one of the old textbooks, printed on real paper, and it was fragile with age. She had been trusted by the librarian to take good care of it. Now, page after page was torn and unreadable. She looked up at him, shame and misery on her face. "Father," she said, "the book, I—" He saw that the unicorn was a bull considerably larger than the average. Men had in the past killed unicorns with spears, but never before had a 16-year-old girl done so. He looked back at her, keeping his face emotionless, and asked sternly, "You what?"
I guess I didn't have any right to take the book out of town. I wish I hadn't."
"You promised to take good care of it," he told her coldly. "Your promise was believed, and you were trusted to keep it."
But I didn't mean to damage it. I didn't mean to."
She was suddenly very near to tears.
"I'm not a Behmen."
"Go back to town," he ordered. "Tonight, bring the book to the town hall and tell the council what happened to it." She swallowed and said in a faint voice,
"Yes, father."
She turned and started slowly back down the hill, not seeing the unicorn as she passed it, the bloody spear trailing disconsolately behind her and her head hanging in shame. He watched her go, and it was safe for him to smile. When night came and she stood before the council, ashamed to lift her eyes to look at them, he would have to be grim and stern as he told her how she had been trusted and how she had betrayed that trust. But now, as he watched her go down the hill, he could smile with his pride in her and know that his question was answered, that the younger generation had lost neither courage nor loyalty. Julia saved a child's life that spring and almost lost her own. The child was playing under a half-completed canopy when a sudden, violent wind struck it and transformed it into a death trap of crackling, falling timbers. She reached him in time to fling him to safety, but the collapsing roof caught her before she could make her own escape. Her chest and throat were torn by the jagged ends of the broken poles, and for a day and a night her life was a feebly flickering spark. She began to rally on the second night, and on the third morning she was able to speak for the first time, her eyes dark and tortured with fear.
"My baby, what did it do to him?"
She convalesced slowly, haunted by the fear. Her son was born 5 weeks later, and her fears proved to have been groundless. He was perfectly normal and healthy. And hungry. And her slowly healing breasts would be dry for weeks to come. By a coincidence that had never happened before and could never happen again, there was not a single feeding-time foster mother available for the baby. There were many expectant mothers, but only three women had young babies, and each of the three had twins to feed. But there was a small supply of frozen goat milk in the ice house, enough to see young Johnny through until it was time for the goat herd to give milk. He would have to live on short rations until then, but it could not be helped. Johnny was a month old when the opportunity came for the men of Ragnarok to have their ultimate ally. The last of the unicorns were going north, and the prowlers had long since gone. The blue star was lighting the night like a small sun when the breeze coming through Schroeder's window brought the distant squealing of unicorns. He listened, wondering. It was a sound that did not belong. Everyone was safely in the town, most of them in bed, and there should be nothing outside the stockade for the unicorns to fight. He armed himself with spear and crossbow and went outside. He led himself out through the east gate and went toward the sounds of battle. They grew louder as he approached, more furious, as though the battle was reaching its climax. He crossed the creek and went through the trees beyond. There, in a small clearing no more than half a mile from the town, he came upon the scene. A lone prowler was making a stand against two unicorns. Two other unicorns lay on the ground dead, and behind the prowler was the dark shape of its mate lying lifelessly in the grass. There was blood on the prowler, purple in the blue starlight, and gloating rang in the squeals of the unicorns as they lunged at it. The leaps of the prowler were faltering as it fought them, the last desperate defiance of an animal already dying. He brought up the bow and sent a volley of arrows into the unicorns. Their gloating squeals died and they fell. The prowler staggered and fell beside them. It was breathing its last when he reached it, but in the way it looked up at him, he had the feeling that it wanted to tell him something, that it was trying hard to live long enough to do so. It died with a strange appeal in its eyes, and not until then did he see the scar on its shoulder, a scar such as might have been made long ago by the rip of a unicorn's horn. It was the prowler he had known 19 years before. The ground was trampled all around by the unicorns, showing that the prowlers had been besieged all day. He went to the other prowler and saw it was a female. Her breasts showed that she had had pups recently, but she had been dead at least 2 days. Her hind legs had been broken sometime that spring, and they were still only half-healed, twisted, and almost useless. Then that was why the two of them were so far behind the other prowlers. Prowlers, like the wolves, coyotes, and foxes of Earth, mated for life, and the male helped take care of the young. She had been injured somewhere to the south, perhaps in a fight with unicorns, and her mate had stayed with her as she hobbled her slow way along and killed game for her. The pups had been born, and they had had to stop. Then the unicorns had found them, and the female had been too crippled to fight. He looked for the pups, expecting to find them trampled and dead. But they were alive, hidden under the roots of a small tree near their mother. Prowler pups, alive! They were very young, small and blind and helpless. He picked them up, and his elation drained away as he looked at them. They made little sounds of hunger, almost inaudible, and they moved feebly, trying to find their mother's breasts, and already so weak that they could not lift their heads. Small chunks of fresh meat had been left beside the pups, and he thought of what the prowler's emotions must have been as his mate lay dead on the ground, and he carried meat to their young, knowing they were too small to eat it, but helpless to do anything else for them. And he knew why there had been the appeal in the eyes of the prowler as it died, and what it had tried to tell him. Save them, as you once saved me. He carried the pups back past the prowler and looked down at it in passing. "I'll do my best," he said. When he reached the house, he laid the pups on his bed and built a fire. There was no milk to give them. The goats would not have young for at least another 2 weeks, but perhaps they could eat a soup of some kind. He put water on to boil and began shredding meat to make them a rich broth. One of them was a male, the other a female, and if he could save them, they would fight beside the men of Ragnarok when the Gurns came. He thought of what he would name them as he worked. He would name the female Segun, after Loki's faithful wife who went with him when the gods condemned him to Hell, the Teutonic underworld. And he would name the male Fenrir, after the monster wolf who would fight beside Loki when Loki led the forces of Hell in the final battle on the day of Ragnarok. But when the broth was prepared and cooled enough, the pups could not eat it. He tried making it weaker, tried it mixed with corn and herb soup, tried corn and herb soups alone. They could eat nothing he prepared for them. When the gray daylight entered the room, he had tried everything possible and had failed. He sat wearily in his chair and watched them, defeated. They were no longer crying in their hunger, and when he touched them, they did not move as they had done before. They would be dead before the day was over, and the only chance men had ever had to have prowlers as their friends and allies would be gone. End of Episode 10. Episode 11 of Space Prison by Tom Godwin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Space Prison, Episode 11. The first rays of sunrise were coming into the room, revealing fully the frail thinness of the pups, when there was a step outside and Julia's voice. "Father?" "Come in, Julia," he said, not moving. She entered, still a pale shadow of the reckless girl who had fought a unicorn, even though she was slowly regaining her normal health. She carried young Johnny in one arm, in her other hand his little bottle of milk. Johnny was hungry, there was never quite enough milk for him, but he was not crying. Ragnarok children did not cry. She saw the pups, and her eyes went wide. "Prowlers! Baby prowlers! Where did you get them?" He told her, and she went to them, to look at them and say, "If you and their father hadn't helped each other that day, they wouldn't be here, nor you, nor I, nor Johnny, none of us in this room." "They won't live out the day," he said. "They have to have milk, and there isn't any." She reached down to them, and they seemed to sense that she was someone different. They stirred, making tiny whimpering sounds, and tried to move their heads to nuzzle at her fingers. Compassion came to her face, like a soft light. "They're so young," she said. "So terribly young to have to die." She looked at Johnny and at the little bottle that held his too small morning ration of milk. "Johnny, Johnny," her words were almost a whisper. "You're hungry, but we can't let them die. And some day, for this, they will fight for your life." She sat on the bed and placed the pups in her lap beside Johnny. She lifted a little black head with gentle fingers, and a little pink mouth ceased whimpering as it found the nipple of Johnny's bottle. Johnny's gray eyes darkened with the storm of approaching protest. Then the other pup touched his hand, crying in its hunger, and the protest faded as surprise and something like sudden understanding came into his eyes. Julia withdrew the bottle from the first pup and transferred it to the second one. Its crying ceased, and Johnny leaned forward to touch it again, and the one beside it. He made his decision with an approving sound and leaned back against his mother's shoulder, patiently awaiting his own turn, and their presence accepted as though they had been born his brother and sister. The golden light of the new day shone on them, on his daughter and grandson and the prowler pups, and in it he saw the bright omen for the future. His own role was nearing its end, but he had seen the people of Ragnarok conquer their environment insofar as Big Winter would never let it be conquered. The last generation was being born, the generation that would meet the Gurns, and now they would have their final ally. Perhaps it would be Johnny who led them on that day, as the omens seemed to prophesy. He was the son of a line of leaders, born to a mother who had fought and killed a unicorn. He had gone hungry to share what little he had with the young of Ragnarok's most proud and savage species, and Fenrir and Segun would fight beside him on the day he led the forces of the Hellworld in the battle with the Gurns, who thought they were gods. Could the Gurns hope to have a leader to match? Part 4. John Humboldt, leader, stood on the wide stockade wall and watched the lowering sun touch the western horizon, far south of where it had set when he was a child. Big summer was over, and now, in the year 200, they were already 3 years into Big Fall. The Craigs had been impassable with snow for 5 years, and the country at the north end of the plateau, where the iron had been found, had been buried under never-melting snow and growing glaciers for 20 years. There came the soft tinkling of ceramic bells as the herd of milk-goats came down off the hills. Two children were following, and six prowlers walked with them, to protect them from wild unicorns. There were not many of the goats. Each year the winters were longer, requiring the stocking of a larger supply of hay. The time would come when the summers would be so short and the winters so long that they could not keep goats at all. And by then, when big winter had closed in on them, the summer seasons would be too short for the growing of the orange corn. They would have nothing left but the hunting. They had, he knew, reached and passed the zenith of development of their environment. From a low of 49 men, women, and children in dark caves, they had risen to a town of 6,000. For a few years they had had a way of life that was almost a civilization, but the inevitable decline was already underway. The years of frozen sterility of big winter were coming, and no amount of determination or ingenuity could alter them. 6,000 would have to live by hunting, and 100, in the first big winter, had found barely enough game. They would have to migrate in one of two different ways. They could go to the south as nomad hunters, or they could go to other, fairer worlds in ships they took from the Gurns. The choice was very easy to make, and they were almost ready. In the workshop at the farther edge of town, the hyperspace transmitter was nearing completion. The little smelter was waiting to receive the lathe and other iron and steel and turn them into the castings for the generator. Their weapons were ready, the mockers were trained, the prowlers were waiting. And in the massive corral beyond town, 40 half-tame unicorns trampled the ground and hated the world, wanting to kill something. They had learned to be afraid of Ragnarok men, but they would not be afraid to kill Gurns. The children with the goats reached the stockade and two of the prowlers, Fenrir and Segin, turned to see him standing on the wall. He had made a little motion with his hand, and they came running, to leap up beside him on the 10-foot-high wall. "So, you've been checking up on how well the young ones guard the children?" he asked. Segin lolled out her tongue, and her white teeth grinned at him in answer. Fenrir, always the grimmer of the two, made a sound in his throat in reply. Prowlers developed something like a telepathic rapport with their masters, and could sense their thoughts and understand relatively complex instructions. Their intelligence was greater, and of a far more mature order, than that of the little mockers, but their vocal cords were not capable of making the sounds necessary for speech. He rested his hands on their shoulders, where their ebony fur was frosted with gray. Age had not yet affected their quick, flowing movement, but they were getting old. They were only a few weeks short of his own age. He could not remember when they had not been with him. Sometimes it seemed to him he could remember those hungry days when he and Fenrir and Segin shared together in his mother's lap, but it was probably only his imagination from having heard the story told so often. But he could remember for certain when he was learning to walk, and Fenrir and Segin, full grown then, walked tall and black beside him. He could remember playing with Segin's pups, and he could remember Segin watching over them all, sometimes giving her pups a bath and his face a washing with equal disregard for their and his protests. Above all, he could remember the times when he was almost grown, the wild, free days when he and Fenrir and Segin had roamed the mountains together. With a bow and a knife and two prowlers beside him, he had felt that there was nothing on Ragnarok that they could not conquer, that there was nothing in the universe they could not defy together. There was a flicker of black movement, and a young messenger prowler came running from the direction of the council hall, a speckle-faced mocker clinging to its back. It leaped up on the wall beside him, and the mocker, one that had been trained to remember and repeat messages verbatim, took a breath so deep that its cheeks bulged out.
It spoke, in a quick rush like a child that is afraid it might forget some of the words.
"Will you please come to the Council Hall to lead the discussion regarding the last preparations for the meeting with the Gurns? The transmitter is completed."
The lathe was torn down the next day, and the smelter began to roar with its forced draft. Excitement and anticipation ran through the town like a fever. It would take perhaps 20 days to build the generator, working day and night so that not an hour of time would be lost, 40 days for the signal to reach Athena, and 40 days for the Gurn cruiser to reach Ragnarok. In 100 days the Gurns would be there. The men who would engage in the fight for the cruiser quit trimming their beards. Later, when it was time for the Gurns to appear, they would discard their woolen garments for ones of goatskin. The Gurns would regard them as primitive inferiors at best, and it might be of advantage to heighten the impression. It would make the awakening of the Gurns a little more shocking. An underground passage, leading from the town to the concealment of the woods in the distance, had long ago been dug. Through it the women and children would go when the Gurns arrived. There was a level area of ground, just beyond the south wall of town, where the cruiser would be almost certain to land. The town had been built with that thought in mind. Woods were not far from both sides of the landing site, and unicorn corrals were hidden in them. From the corrals would come the rear flanking attack against the Gurns. The prowlers, of course, would be scattered among all the forces. The generator was completed and installed on the 19th night. Charlie Craig, a giant of a man whose red beard gave him a genially murderous appearance, opened the valve of the water pipe. The new wooden turbine stirred, and belts and pulleys began to spin. The generator hummed, the needles of the dials climbed, flickered, and steadied. Norman Lake looked from them to Humboldt, his pale gray eyes coldly satisfied.
"Full output," he said. "We have the power we need this time."
Jim Chiara was at the transmitter, and they waited while he threw switches and studied dials. Every component of the transmitter had been tested, but they had not had the power to test the complete assembly.
"That's it," he said at last, looking up at them. "She's ready, after almost 200 years of wanting her."
Humboldt wondered what the signal should be, and saw no reason why it should not be the same one that had been sent out with such hope 165 years ago.
"All right, Jim," he said. "Let the Gurns know we're waiting for them. Make it Ragnarok calling again."
The transmitter key rattled, and the all-wave signal that the Gurns could not fail to receive went out at a velocity of 5 light-years a day.
"Ragnarok calling! Ragnarok calling! Ragnarok calling!"
It was the longest summer Humboldt had ever experienced. He was not alone in his impatience. Among all of them, the restlessness flamed higher as the slow days dragged by, making it almost impossible to go about their routine duties. The gentle mockers sensed the anticipation of their masters for the coming battle, and they became nervous and apprehensive. The prowlers sensed it, and they paced about the town in the dark of night, watching, listening, on ceaseless guard against the mysterious enemy their masters waited for. Even the unicorns seemed to sense what was coming, and they rumbled and squealed in their corrals at night, red-eyed with the lust for blood, and sometimes attacking the log walls with blows that shook the ground. The interminable days went their slow succession, and summer gave way to fall. The 100th day dawned, cold and gray, with the approach of winter, the day of the Gurns. But no cruiser came that day, nor the next. He stood again on the stockade wall in the evening of the 3rd day, Fenrir and Segun beside him. He listened for the first dim, distant sound of the Gurn cruiser, and heard only the moaning of the wind around him. Winter was coming. Always on Ragnarok, winter was coming, or the brown death of summer. Ragnarok was a harsh and barren prison, and no amount of desire could ever make it otherwise. Only the coming of a Gurn cruiser could ever offer them the bloody, violent opportunity to regain their freedom. But what if the cruiser never came? It was a thought too dark and hopeless to be held. They were not asking a large favor of fate, after 200 years of striving for it, only the chance to challenge the Gurn Empire with bows and knives. Fenrir stiffened, the fur lifting on his shoulders and a muted growl coming from him. Then Humboldt heard the first whisper of sound, a faint, faraway roaring that was not the wind. He watched and listened, and the sound came swiftly nearer, rising in pitch and swelling in volume. Then it broke through the clouds, tall and black and beautifully deadly. It rode down on its rockets of flame, filling the valley with its thunder, and his heart hammered with exultation. It had come. The cruiser had come. He turned and dropped the 10 feet to the ground inside the stockade. The warning signal was being sounded from the center of town, a unicorn horn that gave out the call they had used in the practice alarms. Already the women and children would be hurrying along the tunnels that led to the temporary safety of the woods beyond the town. The Gurns might use their turret blasters to destroy the town and all in it before the night was over. There was no way of knowing what might happen before it ended. But whatever it was, it would be the action they had all been wanting. He ran to where the others would be gathering, Fenrir and Segun loping beside him, and the horn ringing wild and savage and triumphant as it was announced the end of 2 centuries of waiting. The cruiser settled to earth in the area where it had been expected to land, towering high above the town with its turret blasters looking down upon the houses. Charlie Craig and Norman Lake were waiting for him on the high steps of his own house in the center of town, where the elevation gave them a good view of the ship, yet where the fringes of the canopy would conceal them from the ship's scanners. They were heavily armed, their prowlers beside them and their mockers on their shoulders. Elsewhere, under the connected rows of concealing canopies, armed men were hurrying to their prearranged stations. Most of them were accompanied by prowlers, bristling and snarling as they looked at the alien ship. A few men were deliberately making themselves visible not far away, going about unimportant tasks with only occasional and carefully disinterested glances toward the ship. They were the bait to lure the first detachment into the center of town. "Well?" Norman Lake asked, his pale eyes restless with his hunger for violence. "There's our ship. When do we take her?" "Just as soon as we get them outside it," he said. "We'll use the plan we first had. Wait until they send a full force to rescue the first detachment, and then we hit them with everything we have." His black, white-nosed mocker was standing in the open doorway and watching the hurrying men and prowlers with worried interest. Tip, the great-great-great-grandson of the mocker that had died with Howard Lake north of the plateau. He reached down to pick him up and set him on his shoulder, and said, "Jim?"
"The longbows are ready,"
Tip's treble imitation of Jim Chiara's voice answered.
"We'll black out their searchlights when the time comes."
"Andy?" he asked.
"The last of us for this section are coming in now,"
Andy Taylor answered. He made his check of all the sub-leaders, then looked up to the roof to ask,
"All set, Jimmy?"
Jimmy Stevens' grinning face appeared over the edge.
10 crossbows are cocked and waiting up here. Bring us our targets."
They waited while the evening deepened into near dusk. Then the airlock of the cruiser slid open and 13 Gurns emerged, the one leading them wearing the resplendent uniform of a sub-commander. "There they come," he said to Lake and Craig. "It looks like we'll be able to trap them in here and force the commander to send out a full-sized force. We'll all attack at the sound of the horn. And if you can hit their rear flanks hard enough with the unicorns to give us a chance to split them from this end, some of us should make it to the ship before they realize up in the control room that they should close the airlocks." "Now," he He looked at the Gurns who were coming straight toward the stockade wall, ignoring the gate to their right. "You'd better be on your way. We'll meet again before long in the ship." Fenrir and Segun looked from the advancing Gurns to him with question in their eyes after Lake and Craig were gone, Fenrir growling restlessly. "Pretty soon," he said to them. "Right now it would be better if they didn't see you. Wait inside, both of you." They went reluctantly inside to merge with the darkness of the interior. Only an occasional yellow gleam of their eyes showed that they were crouched to spring just inside the doorway. He called to the nearest unarmed man, not loud enough to be heard by the Gurns. "Cliff, you and Sam Anders come here. Tell the rest to fade out of sight and get armed." Cliff Schroeder passed the command along, and he and Sam Anders approached. He looked back at the Gurns and saw they were within 100 feet of the, for them, unscalable wall of the stockade. They were coming without hesitation. A pale blue beam lashed down from one of the cruiser's turrets, and a 50-foot section of the wall erupted into dust with a sound like thunder. The wind swept the dust aside in a gigantic cloud, and the Gurns came through the gap, looking neither to the right nor left. "That, I suppose," Sam Anders said from beside him, "was lesson number one for degenerate savages like us. Gurns, like gods, are not to be hindered by man-made barriers." The Gurns walked with a peculiar gait that puzzled him, until he saw what it was. They were trying to come with the arrogant military stride affected by the Gurns, and in the 1.5 gravity they were succeeding in achieving only a heavy clumping. They advanced steadily, and as they drew closer he saw that in the right hand of each Gurn soldier was a blaster, while in the left hand of each could be seen the metallic glitter of chains. Schroeder smiled thinly. "It looks like they want to subject about a dozen of us to some painful questioning." No one else was any longer in sight, and the Gurns came straight toward the three on the steps. They stopped 40 feet away at a word of command from the officer, and Gurns and Ragnarok men exchanged silent stares. The faces of the Ragnarok men bearded and expressionless, the faces of the Gurns hairless and reflecting a contemptuous curiosity.
"Narth!"
The communicator on the Gurn officer's belt spoke with metallic authority.
"What do they look like? Did we come 200 light-years to view some animated vegetables?"
"No, Commander," Narth answered. "I think the discard of the rejects 200 years ago has produced for us an unexpected reward. There are three natives under the canopy before me, and their physical perfection and complete adaptation to this hellish gravity is astonishing."
"They could be used to replace expensive machines on some of the outer world mines," the commander said, "providing their intelligence isn't too abysmally low. What about that?"
"They can surely be taught to perform simple manual labor," Narth answered.
"Get on with your job," the commander said. "Try to pick some of the most intelligent-looking ones for questioning. I can't believe these cattle sent that message, and they're going to tell us who did. And pick some young, strong ones for the medical staff to examine, ones that won't curl up and die after the first few cuts of the knife."
"We'll chain these three first," Narth said.
He lifted his hand in an imperious gesture to Humboldt and the other two and ordered an accented Terran,
"Come here."
No one moved, and he said again sharply,
"Come here."
Again no one moved, and the minor officer beside Narth said,
"Apparently they can't even understand Terran now."
"Then we'll give them some action they can understand," Narth snapped, his face flushing with irritation. "We'll drag them out by their heels."
The Gurns advanced purposefully, three of them holstering their blasters to make their chains ready. When they had passed under the canopy and could not be seen from the ship, Humboldt spoke.
"All right, Jimmy."
The Gurns froze in mid-stride, suspicion flashing across their faces.
"Look up on the roof," he said in Gurn.
They looked, and the suspicion became gaping dismay.
"You can be our prisoners, or you can be corpses," he said. "We don't care which."
The urgent hiss of Narth's command broke their indecision.
"Kill them!"
Six of them tried to obey, bringing up their blasters in movements that seemed curiously heavy and slow, as though the gravity of Ragnarok had turned their arms to wood. Three of them almost lifted their blasters high enough to fire at the steps in front of them before arrows went through their throats. The other three did not get that far. Narth and the remaining six went rigid, motionless, and said to them,
"Drop your blasters, quick!"
Their blasters thumped to the ground, and Jimmy Stevens and his bowmen slid off the roof. Within a minute the Gurns were bound with their own chains, but for the officer and the blasters were in the hands of the Ragnarok men. Jimmy looked down the row of Gurns and shook his head.
"So these are Gurns?" he said. "It was like trapping a band of woods goats."
"Young ones," Schroeder amended, "and almost as dangerous." Narth's face flushed at the words, and his eyes went to the ship. The sight of it seemed to restore his courage, and his lips drew back in a snarl.
"You fools! You stupid, megalomaniac dung-heaps! Do you think you can kill Gurns and live to boast about it?"
"Keep quiet," Humboldt ordered, studying him with curiosity. Narth, like all the Gurns, was different from what they had expected. It was true the Gurns had strode into their town with an attempt at arrogance, but they were harmless in appearance, soft of face and belly, and the snarling of the red-faced Narth was like the bluster of a cornered scavenger rodent.
"I promise you this," Narth was saying viciously. "If you don't release us and return our weapons this instant, I'll personally oversee the extermination of you and every savage in this village, with the most painful death science can contrive, and I'll—"
Humboldt reached out his hand and flicked Narth under the chin. Narth's teeth cracked loudly together, and his face twisted with the pain of a bitten tongue. "Tie him up, Jess," he said to a man near him. "If he opens his mouth again, shove your foot in it." He spoke to Schroeder. "We'll keep three of the blasters and send two to each of the other front groups. Have that done." Dusk was deepening into darkness, and he called Chiara again. "They'll turn on their searchlights any minute and make the town as light as day," he said. "If you can keep them blacked out until some of us have reached the ship, I think we'll have won."
"They'll be kept blacked out," Chiara said, "with some flint-headed arrows left over for the Gurns."
He called Lake and Krieg to be told they were ready and waiting.
"But we're having hell keeping the unicorns quiet," Krieg said. "They want to get to killing something."
He pressed the switch of the communicator, but it was dead. They had, of course, transferred to some other wavelength, so he could not hear the commands. It was something he had already anticipated. Fenrir and Segun were still obediently inside the doorway, almost frantic with desire to rejoin him. He spoke to them, and they bounded out, snarling at the three Gurns in passing and causing them to blanch to a dead white color. He set Tip on Segun's shoulders and said, "Segun, there's a job for you and Tip to do. A dangerous job. Listen, both of you." The yellow eyes of Segun and the dark eyes of the little mocker looked into his as he spoke to them, and accompanied his words with the strongest, clearest mental images he could project. "Segun, take Tip to the not-men thing. Leave him hidden in the grass to one side of the big hole in it. Tip, you wait there. When the not-men come out, you listen, and tell what they say. Now, do you both understand?" Segun made a sound that meant she did, but Tip clutched at his wrist with little paws suddenly gone cold and wailed,
"No! Scared! Scared!"
"You have to go, Tip," he said, gently disengaging his wrist. "And Segun will hide near to you and watch over you." He spoke to Segun. "When the horn calls, you run back with him." Again she made the sound signifying understanding, and he touched them both in what he hoped would not be the last farewell. "All right, Segun, go now." She vanished into the gloom of coming night, Tip hanging tightly to her. Fenrir stood with the fur lifted on his shoulders and a half-snarl on his face as he watched her go and watched the place where the Not-Men would appear.
"Where's Freckles?" he asked Jimmy.
"Here," someone said, and came forward with Tip's mate. He set Freckles on his shoulder and the first searchlight came on, shining down from high up on the cruiser. It lighted up the area around them in harsh white brilliance, its reflection revealing the black shadow that was Sagan just vanishing behind the ship. Two more searchlights came on to illuminate the town. Then the Gurns came. They poured out through the airlock and down the ramp, there to form in columns that marched forward as still more Gurns hurried down the ramp behind them. The searchlights gleamed on their battle helmets and on the blades of the bayonets affixed to their rifle-like long-range blasters. Hand blasters and grenades hung from their belts, together with stubby flame guns. They were a solid mass reaching halfway to the stockade before the last of them, the commanding officers, appeared. One of them stopped at the foot of the ramp to watch the advance of the punitive force and give the frightened but faithful Tip the first words to transmit to Freckles.
"The full force is on its way, Commander."
A reply came in Freckles' simulation of the metallic tones of a communicator.
"The key numbers of the confiscated blasters have been checked, and the disturbance rays of the master integrator set. You'll probably have few natives left alive to take as prisoners after those 13 charges explode, but continue with a mopping-up job that the survivors will never forget."
So the Gurns could, by remote control, set the total charges of stolen blasters to explode upon touching the firing stud? It was something new since the days of the old ones. He called Chiara and the other groups quickly to tell them what he had learned. "We'll get more blasters, ones they can't know the numbers of, when we attack," he finished. He took the blaster from his belt and laid it on the ground. The front ranks of the Gurns were almost to the wall by then, a column wider than the gap that had been blasted through it, coming with silent purposefulness. Two blaster beams lanced down from the turrets to smash at the wall. Dust billowed and thunder rumbled as they swept along. A full 300 feet of the wall had been destroyed when they stopped, and the dust hid the ship and made dim glows of the searchlights. It had no doubt been intended to impress them with the might of the Gurns, but in doing so it hid the Ragnarok forces from the advancing Gurns for a few seconds.
"Jim, black out their lights before the dust clears," he called. "Joe, the horn, we attack now!"
The first longbow arrow struck a searchlight, and its glow grew dimmer as the arrow's burden, a thin tube of thick lance tree ink, splattered against it. Another followed. Then the horn rang out, harsh and commanding, and in the distance a unicorn screamed in answer. The savage cry of a prowler came, like a sound to match, and the attack was on. He ran with Fenrir beside him, and to his left and right ran the others with their prowlers. The Lee groups converged as they went through the wide gap in the wall. They ran on into the dust cloud, and the shadowy forms of the Gurns were suddenly before them. A blaster beam cut into them, and a Gurn shouted,
"The natives!"
Other beams sprang into life, winking like pale blue eyes through the dust and killing all they touched. The beams dropped as the first volley of arrows tore through the massed front ranks, to be replaced by others. They charged on, into the blue winking of the blasters and the red lances of the flame guns, with the crossbows rattling and strumming in answer. The prowlers lunged and fought beside them and ahead of them. Black hell creatures that struck the Gurns too swiftly for blasters to find before throats were torn out. The sound of battle turned into a confusion of raging snarls, frantic shouts, and dying screams. A prowler shot past him to join Fenrir, Sagan, and he felt Tip dart up to his shoulder. He made a sound of greeting in passing, a sound that was gone as her jaws closed on a Gurn. The dust cloud cleared a little, and the searchlights looked down on the scene. No longer brilliantly white, but shining through the red-black lance-tree ink as a blood-red glow.
A searchlight turret slid shut and opened a moment later, the light wiped clean. The longbows immediately transformed it into a red glow. The beam of one of the turret blasters stabbed down, to blaze a trail of death through the battle. It ceased as its own light revealed to the Gurn commander that the Ragnarok forces were so intermixed with the Gurn forces that he was killing more Gurns than Ragnarok men. By then, the fighting was so hand-to-hand that knives were better than crossbows. The Gurns fell like harvested corn. Too slow and awkward to use their bayonets against the faster Ragnarok men, and killing as many of one another as men when they tried to use their blasters and flame guns. From the rear there came the command of a Gurn officer, shouted high and thin above the sound of battle.
"Back to the ship! Leave the natives for the ship's blasters to kill!"
The unicorns arrived then to cut off their retreat. End of Episode 11. Episode 12 of Space Prison by Tom Godwin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Space Prison, Episode 12. They came 20 from the east and 20 from the west, in a thunder of hooves, squealing and screaming in their bloodlust, with prowlers a black wave going before them. They struck the Gurns, the prowlers slashing lanes through them while the unicorns charged behind, trampling them, ripping into them with their horns, and smashing them down with their hooves as they vented the pent-up rage of their years of confinement. On the back of each was a rider whose long spear flicked and stabbed into the throats and bellies of Gurns. The retreat was halted and transformed into milling confusion. He led his own groups in the final charge, the prearranged wedge attack, and they split the Gurn force in two. The ship was suddenly just beyond them. He gave the last command to Lake and Craig. "Now, into the ship!" He scooped up a blaster from beside a fallen Gurn and ran toward it. A Gurn officer was already in the airlock, his face pale and strained as he looked back and his hand on the closing switch. He shot him and ran up the ramp as the officer's body rolled down it. Unicorn hooves pounded behind him and 20 of them swept past, their riders leaping from their backs to the ramp. 20 men and 15 prowlers charged up the ramp as a warning siren shrieked somewhere inside the ship. At the same time the airlocks, operated from the control room, began to slide swiftly shut. He was through first, with Fenrir and Segun. Lake and Craig, together with 6 men and 4 prowlers, squeezed through barely in time. Then the airlocks were closed, and they were sealed in the ship. Alarm bells added their sound to the shrieking of the siren, and from the multiple compartment shafts came the whir of elevators dropping with Gurn forces to kill the humans trapped inside the ship. They ran past the elevator shafts without pausing, light and swift in the artificial gravity that was only 2/3 that of Ragnarok. They split forces as long ago planned, 3 men and 4 prowlers going with Charlie Craig in the attempt to take the drive room. Lake and the other 3 men going with him in the attempt to take the control room. They found the manway ladder and began to climb, Fenrir and Segun impatiently crowding their heels. There was nothing on the control room level, and they ran down the short corridor that their maps had showed. They turned left into the corridor that had the control room at its end, and into the concentrated fire of 9 waiting Gurns. Fenrir and Segun went into the Gurns, under their fire before they could drop the muzzles of their blasters, with an attack so vicious and unexpected that what would have been a certain and lethal trap for the humans was suddenly a fighting chance. The corridor became an inferno of blaster beams that cracked and hissed as they met and crossed, throwing little chips of metal from the walls with snapping sounds, and going through flesh with sounds like soft tappings. It was over within seconds. The last Gurn down, and one man still standing beside him, the blonde and nerveless Lake. Thompson and Barber were dead, and Billy West was bracing himself against the wall with a blaster hole through his stomach, trying to say something and sliding to the floor before it was ever spoken. And Sagan was down, blood welling and bubbling from a wound in her chest, while Fenrir stood over her with his snarling, a raging scream as he swung his head in search of a still-living Gurn. Humboldt and Lake ran on, Fenrir raging beside them, and into the control room. Six officers, one wearing the uniform of a commander, were gaping in astonishment and bringing up their blasters in the way that seemed so curiously slow to Humboldt. Fenrir, in his fury, killed two of them, as Lake's blaster and his own killed three more. The commander was suddenly alone, his blaster half-lifted. Fenrir leaped at his throat, and Humboldt shouted the quick command, "Disarm!" It was something the Prowlers had been taught in their training, and Fenrir's teeth clicked short of the commander's throat, while his paws sent the blaster spinning across the room. The commander stared at them with his swarthy face a dark gray, and his mouth still gaping.
"How did you do it?"
he asked in heavily accented Terran.
"Only two of you!"
"Don't talk until you're asked a question," Lake said.
"Only two of you!"
The thought seemed to restore his courage, as sight of the ship had restored Narth's that night, and his tone became threatening.
"There are only two of you, and more guards will be here to kill you within a minute. Surrender to me, and I'll let you go free."
Lake slapped him across the mouth with a backhanded blow that snapped his head back in his shoulders and split his lip.
"Don't talk," he ordered again, "and never lie to us."
The commander spit out a tooth and held his hand to his bleeding mouth. He did not speak again. Tip and Freckles were holding tightly to his shoulder and each other, the racing of their hearts like a vibration, and he touched them reassuringly. "All right now, all safe now," he said. He called Charlie Craig. "Charlie, did you make it?"
"We made it to the drive room, two of us and one Prowler," Charlie answered. "How about you?"
"Norman and I have the control room. Cut their drives to play safe. I'll let you know as soon as the entire ship is ours."
He went to the viewscreen and saw that the battle was over. Chiara was letting the searchlight burn again, and Prowlers were being used to drive back the unicorns from surrendering Gurns.
"I guess we won," he said to Lake. But there was no feeling of victory, none of the elation he thought he would have.
Sagan was dying alone in the alien corridor outside. Sagan, who had nursed beside him and fought beside him and laid down her life for him. "I want to look at her," he said to Lake. Fenrir went with him. She was still alive, waiting for them to come back to her. She lifted her head and touched his hand with her tongue as he examined the wound. It was not fatal. It need not be fatal. He worked swiftly, gently, to stop the bleeding that had been draining her life away. She would have to lie quietly for weeks, but she would recover. When he was done, he pressed her head back to the floor and said, "Lie still, Sagan girl, until we can come to move you. Wait for us and Fenrir will stay here with you." She obeyed, and he left them, the feeling of victory and elation coming to him in full then. Lake looked at him questioningly as he entered the control room, and he said, "She'll live." He turned to the Gurn commander. "First, I want to know how the war is going." The commander looked uncertainly at Lake.
"Just tell the truth," Lake said, "whether you think we'll like it or not."
"We have all the planets but Earth itself," the commander said. "We'll have it soon."
"And the Terrans on Athena?"
"They're still working for us there."
"Now," he said, "you will order every Gurn in this ship to go to his sleeping quarters. They will leave their weapons in the corridors outside, and they will not resist the men who will come to take charge of the ship."
The commander made an effort toward defiance.
"And if I refuse?"
Lake answered, smiling at him with a smile of his that was no more than a quick showing of teeth, and with a savage eagerness in his eyes.
If you refuse, I'll start with your fingers and break every bone to your shoulders. If that isn't enough, I'll start with your toes and go to your hips, and then I'll break your back." The commander hesitated, sweat filming his face as he looked at them. Then he reached out to switch on the all-stations communicator and say into it,
"Attention, all personnel. You will return to your quarters at once, leaving your weapons in the corridors. You are ordered to make no resistance when the natives come."
There was a silence when he had finished, and Humboldt and Laked looked at each other, bearded and clad in animal skins, but standing at last in the control room of a ship that was theirs, in a ship that could take them to Athena, to Earth, to the ends of the galaxy. The commander watched them, on his face the blankness of unwillingness to believe.
"The airlocks," he said. "We didn't close them in time. We never thought you would dare to try to take the ship, not savages in animal skins."
"I know," Humboldt answered. "We were counting on you to think that way."
"No one expected any of you to survive here."
The commander wiped at his swollen lips, wincing, and an almost childlike petulance came into his tone.
"You weren't supposed to survive."
"I know," he said again. "We've made it a point to remember that."
"The gravity, the heat and cold and fever, the animals. Why didn't they kill you?"
"They tried," he said. "But we fought back. And we had a goal, to meet you Gurns again. You left us on a world that had no resources. Only enemies who would kill us. The gravity, the prowlers, the unicorns. So we made them our resources. We adapted to the gravity that was supposed to kill us, and became stronger and quicker than Gurns. We made allies of the prowlers and unicorns who were supposed to be our executioners, and used them tonight to help us kill Gurns. So now we have your ship."
"Yes, you have our ship."
Through the unwillingness to believe on the commander's face and the petulance, there came the triumph of vindictive anticipation.
"The savages of Ragnarok have a Gurn cruiser. But what can they do with it?"
"What can we do with it?" he asked, almost kindly. "We've planned for 200 years what we can do with it. We have the cruiser, and 60 days from now we'll have Athena. That will be only the beginning, and you Gurns are going to help us do it." For 6 days the ship was a scene of ceaseless activity. Men crowded it, asking questions of the Gurn officers and crew, and calmly breaking the bones of those who refused to answer, or who gave answers that were not true. Prowlers stalked the corridors, their cold yellow eyes watching every move the Gurns made. The little mockers began roaming the ship at will, unable any longer to restrain their curiosity, and confident that the men and prowlers would not let the Gurns harm them. One mocker was killed then, the speckle-faced mocker that could repeat messages verbatim. It wandered into a storage cubicle where a Gurn was working alone, and gave him the opportunity to safely vent his hatred of everything associated with the men of Ragnarok. He broke its back with a steel bar and threw it, screaming, into the disposal chute that led to the matter converter. A prowler heard the scream, and an instant later the Gurn screamed, a sound that died in its making as the prowler tore his throat out. No more mockers were harmed. Only one Ragnarok boy was killed. Three fanatical Gurn officers stole knives from the galley and held the boy as hostage for their freedom. When their demands were refused, they cut his heart out. Lake cornered them a few minutes later and, without touching his blaster, disemboweled them with their own knives. He smiled down upon them as they writhed and moaned on the floor, and their moans were heard for a long time by the other Gurns in the ship before they died. No more humans were harmed. They discovered that operation of the cruiser was relatively simple,
basically similar to the operation of Terran ships as described in the textbook the original Lake had written. Most of the operations were performed by robot mechanisms, and the manual operations, geared to the slower reflexes of the Gurns, were easily mastered. They could spend the 40-day voyage to Athena in further learning and practice, so on the sixth day they prepared to depart. The Unicorns had been given the freedom they had fought so well for, and reconnaissance vehicles were loaned from the cruiser to take their place. Later there would be machinery and supplies of all kinds brought in by freighter ships from Athena. Time was precious, and there was a long, long job ahead of them. They blasted up from Ragnarok on the morning of the seventh day, and went into the Black Sea of hyperspace. By then the Gurn commander was no longer of any value to them. His unwillingness to believe that savages had wrested his ship from him had increased until his compartment became his control room to him, and he spent the hours laughing and giggling before an imaginary viewscreen, whereon the cruiser's blasters were destroying, over and over, the Ragnarok town and all the humans in it. But Narth, who had wanted to have them all tortured to death for daring to resist capture, became very cooperative. In the control room his cooperation was especially eager. On the 20th day of the voyage they had let him have what he had been trying to gain by subterfuge, access to the transmitter when no men were within hearing distance. After that his manner abruptly changed. Each day his hatred for them and his secret anticipation became more evident. The 35th day came, with Athena 5 days ahead of them, the day of the execution they had let him arrange for them. Stars filled the transdimensional viewscreen, the sun of Athena in the center. Humboldt watched the space to the lower left, and the flicker came again, a tiny red dot that was gone again within a microsecond, so quickly that Narth in the seat beside him did not see it. It was the quick peak of another ship, a ship that was running invisible with its detector screens up, but which had had to drop them for an instant to look out at the cruiser. Not even the Gurns had ever been able to devise a polarized detector screen. He changed the course and speed of the cruiser, creating an increase in gravity which seemed very slight to him, but which caused Narth to slew heavily in his seat. Narth straightened, and he said to him, "Within a few minutes we'll engage the ship you sent for." Narth's jaw dropped, then came back up.
"So you spied on me?"
"One of our Ragnarok allies did. The little animal that was sitting near the transmitter. They're our means of communication. We learned that you had arranged for a ship en route to Athena to intercept us and capture us."
"So you know?" Narth asked.
He smiled, an unpleasant twisting of his mouth.
"Do you think that knowing will help you any?"
"We expect it to," he answered.
"It's a battleship," Narth said. "It's 3 times the size of this cruiser, the newest and most powerful battleship in the Gurn fleet. How does that sound to you?"
"It sounds good," he said. "We'll make it our flagship."
"Your flagship? Your flagship?"
The last trace of pretense left Narth, and he let his full and rankling hatred come through.
"You got this cruiser by trickery, and learned how to operate it after a fashion because of an animal-like reflex abnormality. For 42 days you accidental mutants have given orders to your superiors and thought you were our equals. Now your fool's paradise is going to end."
The red dot came again, closer, and he once more altered the ship's course. He had turned on the course analyzer, and it clicked as the battleship's position was correlated with that of its previous appearance. A short yellow line appeared on the screen to forecast its course for the immediate future. "And then?" he asked curiously, turning back to Narth.
"And then we'll take all of you left alive back to your village. The scenes of what we do to you and your village will be televised to all Gurn-held worlds. It will be a valuable reminder for any who have forgotten the penalty for resisting Gurns."
The red dot came again. He punched the battle station's button, and the board responded with a row of ready lights. "All the other Gurns are by now in their acceleration couches," he said. "Strap yourself in for high acceleration maneuvers. We'll make contact with the battleship within 2 minutes." Narth did so, taking his time as though it was something of little importance.
"There will be no maneuvers. They'll blast the stern and destroy your drive immediately upon attack."
He fastened the last strap and smiled, taunting assurance in the twisted unpleasantness of it.
"The appearance of this battleship has very much disrupted your plans to strut like conquering heroes among the slaves on Athena, hasn't it?"
"Not exactly," Humboldt replied. "Our plans are a little broader in scope than that. There are 2 new cruisers on Athena, ready to leave the shops 10 days from now. We'll turn control of Athena over to the humans there, of course, then we'll take the 3 cruisers and the battleship back by way of Ragnarok. There we'll pick up all the Ragnarok men who are neither too old nor too young and go on to Earth. They will be given training en route in the handling of ships. We expect to find no difficulty in breaking through the Gurn lines around Earth, and then, with the addition of the Earth ships, we can easily capture all the Gurn ships in the solar system."
"Easily?" Narth made a contemptuous sneer of the word. "Were you actually so stupid as to think that you biological freaks could equal Gurn officers who have made a career of space warfare?"
"We'll far exceed them," he said. "A space battle is one of trying to keep your blaster beams long enough on one area of the enemy ship to break through its blaster shields at that point, and at the same time try to move and dodge fast enough to keep the enemy from doing the same thing to you. The ships are capable of accelerations up to 50 gravities or more, but the acceleration limiter is the safeguard that prevents the ship from going into such a high degree of acceleration or into such a sudden change of direction that it would kill the crew. We from Ragnarok are accustomed to 1.5 gravity and can withstand much higher degrees of acceleration than Gurns or any other race from a 1-gravity world. To enable us to take advantage of that fact, we have had the acceleration limiter on this cruiser disconnected."
"Disconnected?"
Narth's contemptuous regard vanished in frantic consternation.
"You fool! You don't know what that means! You'll move the acceleration lever too far and kill us all!"
The red dot flicked on the viewscreen, trembled, and was suddenly a gigantic battleship in full view. He touched the acceleration control, and Narth's next words were cut off as his diaphragm sagged. He swung the cruiser in a curve, and Narth was slammed sideways, the straps cutting into him and the flesh of his face pulled lopsided by the gravity. His eyes, bulging, went blank with unconsciousness. The powerful blasters of the battleship blossomed like a row of pale blue flowers, concentrating on the stern of the cruiser. A warning siren screeched as they started breaking through the cruiser's shields. He dropped the detector screen that would shield the cruiser from sight, but not from the blaster beams, and tightened the curve until the gravity dragged heavily at his own body. The warning siren stopped as the blaster beams of the battleship went harmlessly into space, continuing to follow the probability course plotted from the cruiser's last visible position and the course by the battleship's robot target tracers. He lifted the detector screen to find the battleship almost exactly where the cruiser's course analyzers had predicted it would be. The blasters of the battleship were blazing their full concentration of firepower into an area behind and to one side of the cruiser. They blinked out at sight of the cruiser in its new position, and blazed again a moment later, boring into the stern. He dropped the detector screen and swung the cruiser in another curve, spiraling in the opposite direction. As before, the screech of the alarm siren died as the battleship's blasters followed the course given them by the course analyzers, and target tracers that were built to presume that all enemy ships were acceleration limiter equipped.
The cruiser could have destroyed the battleship at any time, but they wanted to capture their flagship unharmed. The maneuvering continued, the cruiser drawing closer to the battleship. The battleship, in desperation, began using the same hide-and-jump tactics the cruiser used, but it was of little avail. The battleship moved at known acceleration limits, and the cruiser's course analyzers predicted each new position with sufficient accuracy. The cruiser made its final dash in a tightening spiral, its detector screen flickering on and off. It struck the battleship at a matched speed, with a thump and ringing of metal as the magnetic grapples fastened the cruiser like a leech to the battleship's side. In that position, neither the forward nor stern blasters of the battleship could touch it. There remained only to convince the commander of the battleship that further resistance was futile. This he did with a simple ultimatum to the commander.
"This cruiser is firmly attached to your ship, its acceleration limiter disconnected. Its drives are of such sufficient power to thrust both ships forward at much higher degree of acceleration than persons from one-gravity worlds can endure. You will surrender at once, or we shall be forced to put these two ships into a curve of such short radius and at an acceleration so great that all of you will be killed." Then he added, "If you surrender, we'll do somewhat better by you than you did with the humans 200 years ago. We'll take all of you on to Athena."
The commander, already sick from acceleration that would have been negligible to Ragnarok men, had no choice. His reply came, choked with acceleration sickness and the greater sickness of defeat.
"We will surrender."
Narth regained consciousness. He saw Humboldt sitting beside him as before, with no Gurn rescuers crowding into the control room with shouted commands and drawn blasters.
"Where are they?" he asked. "Where is the battleship?"
"We captured it," he said.
"You captured? A Gurn battleship?"
"It wasn't hard," he said. "It would have been easier if only Ragnarok men had been on the cruiser. We didn't want to accelerate to any higher gravities than absolutely necessary because of the Gurns on it."
"You did it. You captured the battleship,"
Narth said, his tone like one dazed. He wet his lips, staring, as he contemplated the unpleasant implications of it.
"Your freak mutants who can capture a battleship. Maybe you will take Athena and Earth from us. But—"
the animation of hatred returned to his face.
"What good will it do you? Did you ever think about that?"
"Yes," he said. "We've thought about it."
"Have you?"
Narth leaned forward, his face shining with the malice of his gloating.
"You can never escape the consequences of what you have done. The Gurn Empire has the resources of dozens of worlds. The Empire will build a fleet of special ships, a force against which your own will be nothing, and send them to Earth and Athena and Ragnarok. The Empire will smash you for what you have done, and if there are any survivors of your race left, they will cringe before Gurns for 100 generations to come. Remember that while you're posturing in your little hour of glory on Athena and Earth."
"You insist in thinking we'll do as Gurns would do," he said. "We won't delay to do any posturing. We'll have a large fleet when we leave Earth, and we'll go at once to engage the Gurn home fleet. I thought you knew we were going to do that. We're going to cripple and capture your fleet, and then we're going to destroy your empire."
"Destroy the empire? Now?"
Narth stared again. All the gloating was gone as he saw, at last, the quick and inexorable end.
"Now, before we can stop you, before we can have a chance?"
"When a race has been condemned to die by another race, and it fights and struggles and manages somehow to survive, it learns a lesson. It learns it must never again let the other race be in position to destroy it. So,
This is the harvest you reap from the seeds you sowed on Ragnarok 200 years ago.
You understand, don't you? He asked, almost gently. For 200 years, the Gurn Empire has been a menace to our survival as a race. Now the time has come when we shall remove it.
He stood in the control room of the battleship and watched Athena's sun in the viewscreen, blazing like a white flame. Segun, fully recovered, was stretched out on the floor near him, twitching and snarling a little in her sleep as she fought again the battle with the Gurns. Fenrir was pacing the floor, swinging his black, massive head restlessly, while Tip and Freckles were examining with fascinated curiosity the collection of bright metals that had been cleaned out of the Gurn commander's desk. Lake and Craig left their stations, as impatient as Fenrir, and came over to watch the viewscreen with him.
"One day more," Craig said. "We're 200 years late, but we're coming into the world that was to have been our home."
"It can never be now," he said. "Have any of us ever thought of that? That we're different to humans, and there's no human world we could ever call home?"
"I've thought of it," Lake said. "Ragnarok made us different physically and different in the way we think. We could live on human worlds, but we would always be a race apart and never really belong there."
"I suppose we've all thought about it," Craig said, "and wondered what we'll do when we're finished with the Gurns. Not settle down on Athena or Earth, in a little cottage with a fenced-in lawn, where it would be adventure to watch the 3D shows after each day at some safe, routine job."
"Not back to Ragnarok," Lake said. "With metals and supplies from other worlds, they'll be able to do a lot there, but the battle is already won. There will be left only the peaceful development, building a town at the equator for big winter, leveling land, planting crops. We could never be satisfied with that kind of a life."
"No," he said, and felt his own restlessness stir in protest at the thought of settling down in some safe and secure environment. "Not Athena, or Earth, or Ragnarok. Not any world we know."
"How long until we're finished with the Gurns?" Lake asked. 10 years? We'll still be young then. Where will we go? All of us who fought the Gurns, and all of the ones in the future who won't want to live out their lives on Ragnarok. Where is there a place for us, a world of our own?"
"Where do we find a world of our own?" he asked, and watched the star clouds creep toward them in the viewscreen, tumbled and blazing and immense beyond conception.
"There's a galaxy for us to explore," he said. "There are millions of suns and thousands of worlds waiting for us. Maybe there are races out there like the Gurns, and maybe there are races such as we were 100 years ago who need our help. And maybe there are worlds out there with things on them such as no man ever imagined. We'll go to see what's there. Our women will go with us, and there will be some worlds on which some of us will want to stay. And always there will be more restless ones coming from Ragnarok. Out there are the worlds and the homes for all of us."
"Of course," Lake said. "Beyond the space frontier. Where else would we ever belong?" It was all settled then, and there was a silence as the battleship plunged through hyperspace, the cruiser running beside her and their drives moaning and thundering, as had the drives of the constellation 200 years before. A voyage had been interrupted then, and a new race had been born. Now they were going on again, to Athena, to Earth, to the farthest reaches of the Gurn Empire, and on to the wild, unknown regions of space beyond. There awaited their worlds, and there awaited their destiny, to be a race scattered across 100,000 light-years of suns, to be an empire such as the galaxy had never known. They, the restless ones, the unwanted and forgotten,
The Survivors. The End of Space Prison by Tom Godwin.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.